Sequence prophecies. These are prophecies for our GPS, our guaranteed prophetic security. Because with prophecy, like I mentioned earlier this morning, you really never know it till it's all over and you can look back on it. But I think the Lord gave a group of prophecies that show things that happen in a lineup, in a row, in a sequence, so that we can look at them and see where we are in the stream of time. Now, I will start right away with a little caveat. That means warning. You might not see some of these the same way I do, which is perfectly all right. The fact is there's a lot of them, and the more there are, the easier it is to line up where we are in the stream of time. So if I do something with one of them you simply don't like, then just ignore me. Okay, why this discourse? Prophecy, of course, is not for its own sake. It's not supposed to show that we're smart or something like that. It's not intellectual symbol solving. And the prophecies we're going to look at are not isolated ones, but a list of them in combination for confidence in where we stand here in 2018. Long-term sequenced prophecies. That's the first one that I'm going to look at. You may notice on your handout on the first page, I have 10 things listed there. And then at the bottom it says some details. The thing at the bottom is numbered by the numbers at the top of the page. In other words, when we look at number one at the bottom of the page and on the following pages will fit it. So the first two-thirds of the page are the prophecies we're going to talk about, and then a little of the detail is listed on the following pages. Okay, long-term sequenced prophecies. And this is just to give us the concept of what sequence prophecies are. Then we're going to look at ones that apply in our day. Daniel 2, you are quite familiar with it. Daniel 2 takes us from Babylon to the mediation. You remember Daniel 2 is the image that Nebuchadnezzar saw, the head of gold, and you go all the way down and you get feet mixed with clay and iron, and finally it says the kingdom fills the whole world. So it is a sequence. It takes you from Babylon, through Persia, through Greece, through Rome, through the dissolution of church and state, and finally to the kingdom itself. You see that at the bottom. I listed Babylon, Persia, Greece, with some dates, Rome, and the stone that strikes them. Won't go into any more than that, but this is here just to give you the concept of what a sequenced prophecy is. It's a prophecy that takes you through steps. In this case, five steps. Six, if you like. Because eventually that stone grows and fills the whole earth. The second one, and these first five are just here for the idea. Daniel 11. I'm sure you've studied Daniel 11, particularly in Volume 3. It starts with Persia, and it goes all the way through to Napoleon Bonaparte with great detail. So there's a sequence for you. We can say Persia was followed by Greece, was followed by Rome, which was followed by Holy Rome, which was followed by Napoleon. And actually, if you take it into the 12th chapter, which I think you should, it takes you all the way to the peaceable kingdom. So again, we've got a prophecy sequenced all the way from the days of Persia to the days either of Bonaparte or going into the 12th chapter to the kingdom itself. Number three, Daniel 12. This is a silly question. Do you have a Bible? open there to Daniel 11 and 12. I do a slightly different division from what brethren traditionally do because to me it makes more sense. I know somebody stuck the chapter division where they did, but I think it's in a bad place. I think Daniel 12 actually starts with probably verse 5. So what I'd like you to see, you're familiar with chapter 11. It starts with Darius, and it goes through all of that tedious detail. Chapter 12, by the way, the whole detail, I think if you caught Brother Russell's drift in prophetic interpretation. The whole detail there is to say, we're looking at Napoleon for one reason. It's the only way you can tell when the time of the end starts. The whole point of chapter 11 is to say, you want to know when the time of the end is? It's Napoleon's Egyptian campaign. So there's lots and lots of verses there with one objective. Here's when the time of the end starts. Chapter 12, still going on. Now, in that time, I bet almost any translation you have says at. It's wrong. It should be in. And I think you know why that's the case. When's the time of the end? 1799. Well, did Michael stand up then? No. Okay, so you know it's wrong. Sometimes the scriptures are really easy to interpret. Michael did not stand up at the time of the end, so the translation's wrong. There is a translation, I don't remember which one now, that says in, and it's obviously the right one. Now, in that time, Michael, the great prince who stands guard over the sons of your people, will arise, and there'll be time of distress such as never was, etc. You go through verse 2, you go through verse 3. Those who have insight will shine brightly like the brightness of the expanse of heavens, and those who lead the many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever, period. That's the real end of chapter 11. 11 takes you to the time of the end, and it says, here's what's going to happen in the time of the end. Michael's going to stand up, he's going to deliver his people, he's going to exalt the church, and it's going to be just lovely. You get a whole picture that way, and it's just delightful. The sequence of chapter 11 is complete that way. And you are ending in the kingdom at the end of verse 3, which you might as well do anyway, because as you see, the rest of chapter 12 reverts back to the time of the end again. You go backwards. Now, as long as we're here, I feel so free in Benton to stand aside and make some little side issue that I would never do because I know I run out of time. But you give me that extra 15 minutes, and oh, I do like to take it. Verse 4, but as for you, Daniel, conceal these words and seal up the book until the time of the end. Nice. Now we've gone through the whole chapter. It's arrived at the time of the end, marked by Napoleon. You see that Jesus is going to stand up in the time of the end, establish the kingdom. And then he says to Daniel, that's it, Daniel. That's really the end of the story, except I'm going to give you a little P.S. here. But nobody's going to get it till the time of the end. Since we're talking about the time of the end, that's when people are going to understand your book. At least Daniel knew that somebody would get it sometime because he sure did. And he, you know, a couple of places he says, oh, that made me sick. I wrote this down. I couldn't figure that out. Seal these words up until the time of the end. Many will go back and forth and knowledge will be increased. I have a minority viewpoint on this too from most of the brethren. But it is Brother Russell's viewpoint. And I think most people don't even know this. It's also Martin Luther's viewpoint. So both the sixth and the seventh messengers in verse 4 make this point. As a matter of fact, I think it's the first chapter of volume 3. Brother Russell says at least three times what it means, many will run to and fro and knowledge will be increased. I know what's in your minds. At least I think I do. You thinking, jet planes, DNA, all the increase of knowledge. Well, Martin Luther and Brother Russell himself did not think primarily that that was the interpretation. I really like what they thought the interpretation was because to me it makes perfect sense. Look at this. Daniel, shut the book up till the time of the end. And then many are going to run to and fro in the verses that you wrote, and they're going to start understanding it. That's what Martin Luther and Brother Russell said with the primary meaning of this verse. Many will run to and fro through the words that you wrote down, and it'll be the time of the end, and they'll start understanding it. It's a lovely, lovely sequence in the context. Okay, hope that didn't upset your lunch. Then I really like what happens where I think chapter 12 should start, and that's verse 5. What happens in verse 5? And following. It does exactly what verse 4 predicted. It says, when the pages are open, when the book is open, it's not going to be opened at 1799. It says they're going to be open gradually. It says, you see this angel standing over the waters. And when's it going to be? Verse 7, time, times, and half a time. That takes you to 1799. The book of Daniel starts to be open then because Napoleon throws the Pope in the clink and the scriptures are available and people start studying them. They're not getting too much at that time. Take it up another 30 years. He says, okay, we're going to go to 1829. 30 years later. And he says, now they're really going to start probing. As it says in Revelation, they're going to get a stomach ache from it. Because this is the Miller movement, and it just caused more consternation. But the fact is, the Miller movement did open up all kinds of things about the book of Daniel, and ultimately leads to the understanding that Jesus would return. So that's step two, the gradual opening of Daniel. What's happening here is God is telling, well, God through Gabriel, is telling Daniel, here's what's going to happen starting in 1799. Your book's going to be open, but it's not going to be open all at once. It's going to start 1799. Something's going to happen in 1829 to progress it. And oh, the blessedness of he who comes to the 1,305 days, because then it will be totally open. Why? Because Brother Russell will tell you it's 1335 here, we know that's the date of the Lord's return. And of course, that's why Brother Russell starts interpreting things. But this is not about Jesus' return. This is about the opening of Daniel. The sequential opening, 1799, 1829, 1874. And that's justified in Revelation 10. Because Revelation 10 is God's explanation of Daniel 12. You get the Miller movement there, you remember? Daniel, not Daniel. The angel says, got this little book open in my hand, eat it. Well, that's what the Miller movement started doing, was eating it. And what happened? Oh, dear. Terrible stomach ache from it. That was prophesied. But then there is that wonderful verse that corresponds with the 1335 days. But in the days of the seventh angel, when he shall surely sound, that is the best translation of that verse. He shall surely sound, or sound with certainty. In other words, you're not going to get a stomach ache from it anymore. This is going to be a true interpretation. In the days of the seventh angel, when he shall sound surely, the mystery will be finished. Doesn't mean the church is complete. It means Daniel's open. Finally. It's a wonderful combination. Okay, I really took a lot of side time on that. But I hope it's profitable. Okay, number four. Revelation 3 and 4, you know that is the message to the... Oh, I'm sorry. I have 3 and 4. I'm in 2 and 3. There's mistakes on here. Revelation 2 and 3, not 3. It takes you from Pentecost, when the church is established, to the mediation at the end of the seventh stage of the church. On the second page of your outline, that's number 4 there. I put the 7 periods of the church there. I listed them with the dates that I think are correct. And a little summary of each church. So, Revelation 2 and 3 is another sequenced prophecies. You're going to have the desirable period of the church, Ephesus. You're going to have the bitter persecutions following it, Smyrna. You're going to have the rise to power of the apostasy, that's Pergamos. By the way, when you're walking there in Asia Minor along the road that goes to all these 7 cities, when you get to that third one, you're going down the road and you look up because the road starts rising, and way up on the hill in front of you sits the city of Pergamos. Perfect symbol of earthly elevation when the fake church gets set up in power. Number Thyatira, the dominance of the apostasy. And I've got a space there. That's not a typographical error. But in Revelation, things get divided into 4 plus 3. The true church goes down and the false church goes up for 4 stages. And then the true church comes up and the false stage goes down for 3 stages. That works in the churches and the seals and the trumpets, the whole thing. So that's why I have that little blank there. Number 5, Sardis. The first glimpse of rescue. That's during Wycliffe's day. Number 6, Philadelphia, respect for consecration. By the way, I think that's what brotherly love means. When you look at the Philadelphian stage of the church, Martin Luther is its founder or its messenger. And what Martin Luther did, in essence, was to say, you are a brotherhood. You are not a congregation with priests over you. And therefore, you start respecting each other's personal relationship to God. There's where the brotherly love comes in. It's no longer bow down to the priest and the bishop and the pope and just listen to what they say. It's no, work with each other. Actually, it's kind of Brother Ed's study. Start edifying each other. And that's what happened in Philadelphia. Consequently, you get it spread from one little Lutheran church that breaks apart into all kinds of denominations during that period because they wanted to build each other up. And as they did, they kind of had to fracture in order to do it because they didn't want to get stuck in each other's creeds. And number 7, Laodicea, the final feeding and the completion. Okay, so much for number 4 on page 1. Another long-term sequence prophecy, number 5. That's Revelation 17. And I know that's complicated, and I won't get into it right now in its complication. But if you'll remember, the gist of Revelation 17 is, you see this beast with 7 heads. So there's a sequence there. Unlike some drawings you may have seen with this animal with 7 heads on it, this beast never has more than 1 head at a time. It just gets new heads. One gets cut off and another one gets stuck on. But that's why it's a sequence prophecy. It's taking you through history and telling you what's going to happen, and it tells you when it's going to start happening, because it says that you saw a woman sitting on the beast. So it doesn't happen until the woman sits on the beast. Now, the very first time this harlot gets to sit on the beast is when Justinian says, "You can do that. I'm going to make you the head of the church. You are Pontifex Maximus," translated big cheese. Chief religious ruler. So there's the first time that the church is given the right to sit on the empire. She sits on a beast. So I've listed, and we could go over that for hours too, but we won't. The 7 changes. By the way, you know what a head is. At least most of us feel that our heads think. That's the point of a head, is it does the thinking. And so what it represents is governing philosophies over these big empires. If they change the way they govern, you got a new governing philosophy. And that's what this set list of 7 is based on. So you've got Justinian's Rome in 539. That's followed by Charlemagne's empire. Big change there, because Justinian, while he made the Pope the head of religion, he never said, "You're higher than I am." But when we get to Charlemagne, the Pope puts the crown on his head, which virtually says, "I'm higher than you are, kid." I'm sure that didn't go over with Charlemagne. Then the Holy Roman Empire was founded in 962 under Otto the Great. Then the new Holy Roman Empire in 1648 under Leopold I. You remember, if you read Revelation, which a lot of us don't do because we're scared out of our wits with it, but you may remember it says in chapter 13, one of its heads was wounded, and everybody was just amazed that it came back. Well, right there is when that happened. You had the Holy Roman Empire, and it was wounded, and it came back, and that's the new Holy Roman Empire. Then you've got Napoleonic France, Victor Emmanuel. Oh, I'll do this for Sister Linda. Sister Linda read it earlier this morning wrong. The reprint article says that Victor Emmanuel's the 7th head. Okay, it's all made right. So the reprint says Victor Emmanuel's the 7th head, but in Revelation 17, which is Brother Russell speaking, he says it's the 6th. So by his actual physical presence, it is interpreted for us. Then the Nazi fascist empire, and it doesn't get any more heads. But there we have another sequenced prophecy. Now, you may say, well, that only takes us to 1945. And it does, because that's the end of Nazism. But Revelation 17 goes one step further, and it suggests that this body of the beast gets some sort of relationship. It's an eighth thing that comes. It's not an eighth head. It says there's only 7 heads. But it's an eighth thing that's connected with the previous 7. And what it amounts to is, sidebar here. You remember Brother Russell says the French Revolution is prototype of the final time of trouble. And what happened in the French Revolution? The people rose up. They threw the church and the king out. When we get this eighth thing, that's exactly what happens, because it says the beast that you saw and isn't anymore, That's what you saw in the French Revolution. It comes back. And so it's telling you the people are going to throw religion, civil power, over. Same thing all over again. I don't know. Somewhere in 17. Sorry, Linda. Okay. Well, those first 5 we have looked at, those are all long-term sequence prophecies. They virtually cover the whole age or longer. They go out. Some of them go from Babylon until now. Some of them touch on the history of the gospel age. These are long-term sequence prophecies, but all of them give us a connection to the kingdom somehow. So this is nice. If you relied on any one of them to say, well, we must be close to the kingdom, you'd be right. But if you rely on all 5 of them, you'd say, we must be right. I got 5 of these sequences, and they're all ending up at the same thing. Okay, number 6, which stands there all by itself. Time of the end to the mediation. Well, I want to change that. I don't want to say the mediation. That's another mistake on your handout. Time of the end to the church's completion. There is a difference, because the church gets complete before the mediation starts. I won't read it right now. You probably have it tucked away in your memory somewhere. You'll find it in 2 Kings 2, number 6, first page. Yeah, number 6 on the second page will work too. They go together. You remember 2 Kings 2 brought down to a nutshell. When the Lord decides it's getting time to take the church home, he sends them to several places. He says, well, you go to Gilgal, go to Bethel, go to Jericho, go to Jordan. And then finally Elijah and Elisha cross Jordan, and Elijah goes, whoosh, and he's gone. So we have a sequence here. By the way, in Scripture, in prophecy, places equal. You're used to it in this, because that's the way brethren have usually held on to it. But Brother Russell always says, now he doesn't hear, he puts dates on these. But Brother Russell always says in prophecy, places equal conditions. Yes, the holy of the tabernacle, consecrated condition. The court of the tabernacle, tentatively justified condition. Places in prophecy or in types always represent conditions. I'm going to suggest this. I've got dates here also. They're not the same ones Brother Russell attaches. But if you know what the condition is and the conditions occurs, you can stick a date on it. So, time of the end to the church's completion. Now we're getting pretty personal here, because we're all looking for the church's completion. So on page 2, where you've got number 6, this is all pulled out of 2 Kings, 2nd chapter. First of all, I'd like you to recognize something. Gilgal, Bethel, and Jericho are all what? Places. They're all cities, aren't they? Jordan's not. It's a river. It goes all the way from the top to the Dead Sea. It's different from the other. Okay, Gilgal. I'm going to suggest this is 1799. The word means rolling away. And I'm going to suggest that it means the rolling away of two things. Because you get to 1799, we saw in that one prophecy, Napoleon slammed the Pope into jail. That ended the Pope's ability to persecute the church. It was a dramatic moment in history. It rolled away persecution. But it also rolled away something else, because the Bible societies all of a sudden sprung up, and you could search Scripture, it started to roll away error. So much so, another third volume chapter, so much so that eventually you get to what we call the cleansing of the sanctuary. All the error gets rolled away, and you have a nucleus of brethren that don't have error anymore. So starting there in 1799, you start rolling away persecution power by the papacy. You start rolling away the error. Next place he goes is Bethel. I'm going to suggest that's 1874. What did Brother Russell call the Bible house? Bethel. I don't think that's an accident. And it means house of God. I really like that. During Brother Russell's ministry, that was kind of the worldwide place where God was dwelling and disseminating truth. I really like that. Well, Brother Russell died, as you know, and it caused some consternation. We get to Jericho. I'm going to suggest that's 1914. It means fragrance. By the way, that's pretty much the meaning of the Thyatira church, too. Thyatira means sweet perfume of sacrifice. And the Lord called it that because in the Thyatira period, it was hard to serve the Lord. It cost you something. It was a sweet savor to him because it was the most dark of the dark ages period. There was very little to grab onto. The fourth messenger of the church was Peter Waldo. Almost any brethren that got any information then got it because Peter Waldo was a merchant. And he would hand copy little pieces of scripture and sew them into the hem of his garment. And if he got your trust, you know, he was selling you a diamond. He says, I've got something here worth more than a diamond. Are you interested? It was a very hard time to get truth. And I think Jericho is that condition. Brother Russell falls asleep. Well, no, he's changed. No, both. No, he's not all asleep. He didn't fall asleep. He was changed. Ever since then, we have been in a condition where the Lord looks at us individually and says, I really appreciate your struggle. You don't have the benefit of Brother Russell sitting there in your midst. You are all struggling with the questions that he didn't finally answer. You're all struggling with divisions among yourselves. It is a time of sweet savor, of fragrance, because you've got individual faith you're going to have to deal with. That's been going on since his death. Finally, you get to number four, the next part of this sequenced prophecy. You come to Jordan. It means judged down, or maybe even a decision set. I link this with the concept in the wise and foolish virgins. There comes a certain time the Lord says, okay, I got the wise, putting them in there and shutting the door. Those that are left on the outside, the great company, their decision is set. They can't make it into the church anymore. They're part of the great company. The decision has been set. It's been judged. It's been set down. I think this is the closing of the door in that parable. That hasn't happened yet. They walk together for a little while after that. You may notice. When the decision is made, Elijah and Elisha, after they cross Jordan, they walk together for a short period of time, doesn't say how long, and then bye-bye Elijah. And Elisha gets the mantle, and he has to finish the work. This isn't on your outline, but I put a number five there, the glorification of Elijah. Okay, so that's sequence prophecy number six. In that one, I think we can pretty well say we've only gone through three of five steps. We've got two to look forward yet. Number seven. These 7, 8, 9, and 10 are all harvest period prophecies, but they are sequenced. Let's start with Elijah again. 1 Kings 19. You remember wind, earthquake, fire, and small voice. You all recall that from 1 Kings 19? The details will be on page 2, number 7 at the bottom. But let me draw a little history point here. Well, you know, I better read it. I don't want to get it wrong. 1 Kings 19. 1 Kings 19 is kind of interesting. Elijah, just really going to quick summary here. How many feedings does he get in this chapter? Anybody remember?
Two.
I think one is the feeding that he gets from 1829 until Brother Russell's day. It's the Miller movement, which was a feeding, but if you remember, oh dear, I got a stomachache from that feeding. And quite like the Miller movement, Elijah falls asleep. That first feeding, he's gone, which is what happened. You know, the church got tired of chronology and all that. They just said, they kind of temporary given up arrangement. But he gets fed again. The Lord came again a second time and touched him. This is verse 7. Arise, eat, because the journey is too great for you. There's the message to us in this sequence. You have gone past the cleansing of the sanctuary. You have gone past the Miller movement. If I don't give you some new food, the harvest message, you won't make. Need to be fed because the journey is too great without some new food. And that's why he sends Brother Russell. So he arose and ate and drank and went in the strength of that food 40 days and 40 nights to Horeb, the mountain of God. Let it not be said I don't believe in a 40-year period. I do. This one. This is really quite interesting. Horeb, the mountain of God. When the brethren in Brother Russell's day got this second feeding, what did they expect in 1914? They expect the kingdom. That's kind of what this sounds like, huh? Eat 40, you're going to get to the kingdom. But like all prophecy, we really have to pay attention to the slightest detail. Horeb, the mountain of God. The word Horeb means desolation. Well, you know God's kingdom is not a desolation, but for the brethren it was. They expected the kingdom in 1914 and they got there and what did they find? Their hopes were desolate. So there's this 40-year period. They expect their feeding is going to take them right to the kingdom and they find, it didn't happen. Desolation of their expectations. It's all prophesied right here. Then Brother Russell drops dead, and here we are left in that Jericho period. Okay, so he arose and ate and drank and went through the strength of that food 40 days and 40 nights, 1874 to 1914, to the mountain of God? No, to the desolation about the mountain of God. The disappointment? You know, it's kind of interesting. Both feedings resulted in a disappointment. If you were following Miller, you got disappointed. If you were following Brother Russell, you got disappointed. Both resulted in a desolation of their experience. Okay, then he came there to a cave, and I think this is the brethren in 1914, or at least after Brother Russell's death, and lodged there. And behold, the word of the Lord came to him, and he said to him, and I love this next sentence, especially if you read it right. What are you doing here, Elijah? Don't get stuck at 1914. Get up. You are not done. What are you doing here, Elijah? You goofed. You thought the kingdom was going to be here. You found Horeb instead. A horrible experience, if you pardon the pun. And he said, I have been very zealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the sons of Israel forsaken that covenant, blah, 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 blah. But, verse 11, go forth and stand on the mountain before the Lord. You are in the kingdom, Elijah. Not the way you expected it. You are in the kingdom, but before you see your hopes fulfilled in the kingdom, you're going to have to go through wind, earthquake, and fire. And then you will hear the small comforting voice of be still and know that I am God. So right here in 1914, we, the Elijah class, had fed on that wonderful meal. We had experienced the desolation of hopes. We could have gotten stuck, but the Lord said, what are you doing here? You've got things to do. You've got to go through wind, earthquake, and fire, and then you'll get to that kingdom that you expected. Okay, in page 2 and number 7, I have listed what I think fits wind, earthquake, fire, and still small voice. Wind, of course, means war. And for all practical purposes, the war period was World War I through World War II. So I've listed war as 1914 to 45. Earthquake means some sort of revolution, obviously. I think we have to define it, though, and I think the revolution here is the breakup of the colonial system. Because when those wars ended, you still had colonial systems with Russia in charge of the entire Eastern European sphere. You still had Belgium and Holland and England with their colonies all over the world from the time that they were sea powers. 1914, all of a sudden, 1945 and following, all of a sudden, the earth quakes. And all of those imperial powers lose their colonies. You remember Jesus said, behold the fig tree. And if you read the Luke account, the fig tree and all the trees. I think he was drawing our attention to the fact that not only will Israel pop up at this time. That's not a colonial power arrangement. But he says you're going to see all these other little trees popping up because the old colonial empires are going to be cracked into pieces and all of their little colonies are going to become independent nations. And if you look at the United Nations roster, all of a sudden it goes from a few handful of nations to well over 100 nations. You have the colonial breakup. Now, I'm suggesting fire. Now, Brother Russell and brethren say it's anarchy. I don't mind that. It's not a scriptural word. Terror is a scriptural word. And it is actually starting in 1989, which, by the way, is the end of the earthquake phrase, because when did the final big empire fall apart, the Soviet Union? 1989. And all at that moment, all of the terror started. They wanted to bring down the big towers in New York. They put a bomb in the subway. Didn't work. They got smoke in the garage. It was about later on they had to run planes into them. But the fact is, terrorism starts about that time. It's getting worse. It's the most uncontrollable thing on the face of the earth right now. Doesn't matter what country you are, you cannot predict nor control terrorism. That's a fire. That's a real fire. So Elijah has gone through wind, earthquake, currently going through fire. But if you believe in the sequence of prophecies, what comes next? Ah, finally, we're right on the verge of what we really wanted. That small voice that says, be still and know that I am God. The mediation will begin. This is one of the wonderful things about these sequence prophecies. All of them that we've looked at so far, that's 7 of them. They're all leading you to the kingdom in one way or another, but some with certain detail and some with other detail. And the more of them that we can accept and rely on, the better we can interpret where we are in time. Otherwise, we just guess. Well, I think that this. Well, I think that this. And Brother so-and-so thinks this. Well, okay. But I believe in Scripture. And I think the more Scriptures we can line up, especially sequenced ones that tells you where you are, the more confidence we can have. So I'd say indeed, brethren, look up, lift up your heads, for your deliverance draweth nigh. Yes, okay. All right, now we're going to use pages 1 and 3. Amos 5. This is one we don't talk about too often. So hold on while I find Amos. Daniel, Hosea, Joel, Amos. I've still never yet memorized a sentence that helps me find all the minor prophets. Amos 5. Let's start with verse 18. This is all about fleeing from animals, and I think the animals represent dominant player events. Dominant player meaning big countries. You know, we frequently refer to governments by capitals, don't we? Moscow said, London said, Paris said. But we also refer to them by animals. The Russian bear, the American eagle, the British lion, etc. And I think that's what the Lord is calling to our attention here. Verse 18. Alas, you who are longing for the day of the Lord, for what purpose will the day of the Lord be to you? It will be darkness and not light. This may take us all the way back to poor Elijah when he was in the cave there. And, oh, I want the kingdom. I know, but you don't have it yet. You got to go through wind, earthquake, and fire. But you also have to go through these animals. As when a man flees from a lion. Britain was the dominant power in 1874. Its navy was legendary for controlling the world. And a bear meets him. Well, okay, you get into the 19-teens, and suddenly this Russian bear rises up, most prominently probably after the Second World War. Or goes home, leans his hand against the wall, and a snake bites him. Well, home is probably nationalism, and we still tend to do that. We still tend to do that. The current president. We're going to do what's good for America. The rest of the world, will it happen, whatever happens. Nationalism is still a big force. President Putin, Russia. Yes. Nationalism is a big deal. Every country wants his own country to be big. Okay, so this apparently follows this Russian bear thing, this period of nationalism. And what do? You go home and you try to hold up the wall. Because the walls are cracking, face it. All the national walls are falling apart. And there you are holding up your wall, holding up your individual country, and what happens? A snake bites you. I think that'll be Satan's last stand, and it'll be seen in some other progressive prophecy. But it is virtually saying, if we got it right, we went through Great Britain, we went through Russian dominance, we are in a nationalistic period, and Satan's last stand is going to nip. That goes all the way back to Genesis. The seed of the woman would bruise the serpent's head, but the serpent would bruise his heel. Okay, so I think we're waiting for the snake bite. Okay, next prophecy, number 9. Revelation 16, 7 last plagues. And I know, brethren, see this all kinds of ways. I'm going to tell you the way I see it, and like I said before, you don't have to see it the same way. The point is, the more sequenced prophecies you can call upon, the better, because they'll put them together and they really tell you where we are. Okay, short synopsis. This is an exaggerated statement, but there's a group of brethren that think plagues are all gone. There's a group of brethren that think plagues are all future, and there's a group of brethren, myself included, that think they are progressive. You know, the 20th century, probably the most significant century in man's history prior to the establishment of the kingdom. And there are, to the best of my knowledge, very few prophecies that detail things about the 20th century. I think that's what the plagues are there. I cannot imagine that the scriptures are silent on the sequence of history in the 20th century. And I think the prominent prophecy for that is these 7 last plagues. So I see them as progressive, starting in 1914 and not finished yet. That obviously is at least a whole talk, if not two. See all those initials you have on the right side? Because I put some dates by these plagues. I gave this talk at home, and I wanted to show that brethren have lived in each of these. So all those are initials of people in our ecclesia, except first one, which is Sister Helen Johnson. I think she's 100-some-odd years old now. So she was alive when I think the first plague was there. The rest of us weren't around at that time. But you can see there's more and more there. Brother Joseph King is the last one there because he was born in 95. Okay, here in a nutshell, I understand 1914, First World War, to be the first plague. I think these are sequential. I think following that came the Russian Revolution, 1917. This is a weird one. People laugh at it, but I got good reasons for it. 1931 comes next, the Jehovah's Witnesses. We're so closely allied to what happened with the witnesses that sometimes we don't realize what they've done. Do you realize that those people are the only people in history that have tried to knock on every door in the world? And this is big. It's really big. And what do? They knock on the door, and again, I'm just sort of giving a nutshell summary, but they say, you know what you believe? It's blood. You really shouldn't be drinking that. And while a lot of people never believe them, they do raise questions in people's minds. And that's the undermining of faith, which is one of the functions of these plagues, is to undermine people's faith in things that they've always believed. Okay, go forward to 1939. I think that's the Second World War. Go forward to 1959. I think that's Vatican II Council, which really undermined the Catholic Church. I think you go forward to 1995 for the sixth plague, and I think that's the internet explosion. You know, basically the sixth plague dries up the water of the Euphrates. People stop supporting the old order. And one reason they do that is they're getting more and more information. Where do you get your information? You did it this morning in the study. Turn to Google. Yeah. Yeah. And there is more information available and drawn from all over the world in the information explosion than anybody could have ever imagined. It is a real plague. Not that everything on it is true. It's not. But just all of that information, getting people worked up, getting their minds active. They're seeing all kinds of conspiracies and everything else. Whether it has anything to do with truth or not doesn't matter. The fact is, they're nervous, and it is making them withdraw support. I have to laugh. This is long ago. They did a survey asking the American people whom they trust most and who they trust least. Well, Congress was about the bottom. They really didn't trust Congress. You know who they trusted the most? And this is the funny part. Their garbage man. Because he was always there and picked up the garbage. And very reliable. So if that's not a breakdown. Okay, the seventh plague, of course, is the total breakdown and destruction of everything falling apart. So I don't know how you see the plagues, but as I see them, they add to these sequenced prophecies because they say, okay, we've gone through this, this, and this. According to my understanding, we're in number six. But in number seven, it says, it is finished. I think that's a reference to the church. That's the same as lift up your heads, your deliverance draws nigh. Okay, last one, Matthew 24. By the way, the best thing you can do for yourself is make your own list of sequences. I'm just showing you how this has helped me. But since prophecy is so individual in its interpretation, make up your own sequenced list, because you know which prophecies you rely on and where they tell you you are. Matthew 24. Let's start with 32. Now learn the parable from the fig tree. Very interesting wording. It doesn't say learn the parable of the fig tree. It says, learn a parable from the fig tree. In other words, watch Israel. It is key to your understanding in the fulfillment of prophecy. Learn the parable from the fig tree. When its branch has already become tender and puts forth its leaves, you know that summer is nigh. Leaves in all prophecies represent what? Professions. Yes. And, well, it's April. It's a good time to demonstrate this. If you weren't sure that that tree out there was alive, you go out now and look, and you see leaves, and you say, it's alive. I don't have to cut it down. Okay, and I think what demonstrates the life of a nation is statehood. Therefore, I think the leaves is 1948, when Israel proclaimed that it was alive. Verse 34, Matthew 24:32. Okay, and, I'm glad you stopped me, because I forgot the point. Verse 32, when it puts forth leaves, you know that summer is not. When you read Luke, it's a little clearer that summer is the kingdom. Jesus cannot give us a date. You know, it's in this context, he says, no man knows the date when the mediation starts. But he's saying, I can give you a window of time when the fig tree puts forth its leaves. You know that summer is near. Even so, you too, when you see all these things, and it's the end of a sequence, so it's the last part. Recognize that it should not say he, it is near, right at the door, meaning summer. Verse 34, truly I say to you, this generation will not pass until all these things take place. Brethren have argued about generation for generation. I don't think we have to argue about it. Jesus, within one day, uses this word elsewhere. If you look in chapter 23, verse 36, he's talking to Israel just before his crucifixion. Truly I say to you, all these things, meaning the destruction of the temple, shall come upon what? This generation. What did he mean? He didn't mean a specific number of years. He meant, if you hear me saying this, it is likely that you will still be alive when Jerusalem's destroyed. The meaning shouldn't change just because we went to chapter 24. Truly I say to you, this generation, the one that saw the leaves, will not pass until all these things take place. Now, if that doesn't make you feel close, nothing does. I remember it's happening. A lot of you are too young to remember 1948. Some of us, I won't say who, are old enough. But the statement's basically saying, within my normal lifetime, this should happen. Well, I don't feel old, but I am getting older. So this is one of those sequenced prophecies that's really quite wonderful in giving us sobriety as to how close we are. This generation will not take place until all these things take place. Now he says, heaven and earth, the old order will pass away. But of that day and hour, you don't know. I can't tell you. I don't even know myself. Okay, summer, the mediation. By the way, we can get what I would call peripheral lessons out of that. You remember in the Daniel 2 account when the image is struck on the feet by the stone? It is blown away in the wind of the summer threshing floor. Okay, that prophecy plus this concept shows that there's more than one summer, because Jesus in Matthew 24 also prophesies a winter. So we can take a look at the harvest period and we can say there's a summer in it. I know there's a lot of trouble in it, but as far as prophecy is concerned, the old nations are passing away in the summer of the threshing floor. Harvest still going on. Brethren are still being made part of the body of Christ while this stuff is passing away. The wind of the summer threshing floor. Then Jesus says, Matthew 24:20, pray that your flight may not be in the winter. We've got two summers. We've got the peaceable kingdom. We've got the current harvest. And right in between, we've got that worst time of trouble, the winter. Church will be gone by then, but apparently great company is still going to be having some trouble extricating itself. And that's what he's saying. Pray that your flight not be in the winter. So we went from one set of prophecies, we learn how to handle some others. We've got sequential seasons. Summer, winter, summer. Two of them in the harvest, the third one in the peaceable kingdom. I'm done. May the Lord bless your consideration of prophecies that have sequences in them.